Do you have more pictures of your goats than yourself on your phone? Does your vacation time get spent attending goat shows? Can you have a conversation without bringing up dairy goats? Neither can we. So join us as we talk to the country's best breeders, judges, appraisers, and industry experts about all things dairy goats. We are John Kane and Danielle Caroli. Welcome to Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast.
What's up, everyone, and welcome to Ringside. I'm John, and as always, I'm joined by she's missing the Oscars for this, Danielle Caroli. What's up?
How are you, John?
I'm doing well, Danielle. And before we get even any further, I'm going to introduce our guest here and now, so that way we can continue this conversation, okay?
Okay.
Obviously, today is going to be a fun episode if you've read the description of it. Today, we are joined by Dr. Melissa Hollihan, DVM of Caprine and You Veterinary Consulting, Chubby Acres, and now a small ruminant research associate and lecturer at Washington State University College of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Melissa will be talking to us about the three main diseases we as dairy goat producers test for and actively try to rid our herds of: CAE, yonies, and CL. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Melissa.
Thanks, you guys. I'm super excited to be here tonight and talk about, obviously, my favorite subject, goats.
We're so happy to have you on again.
Yes, yes, yes. And the reason, Danielle, that I decided to introduce Dr. Melissa now is because I know she's probably going to want to chime in, because we have an update for our listeners. Danielle, the bet has concluded. The results are in. How did we fare?
Well, John, I guess I should just start off by saying I was right last week and just go from there, because I don't know what else to say. We finished our kidding bet group with our fourth single in a row. Also, the fourth deal we've had to induce in a row. It's been fun here. I mean, she was one that, like all of these other does, looked very pregnant, looked like she was carrying multiples. She was not carrying multiples. She had a single. Thankfully, it was a doe kid, and it was an AI doe kid, so that is good. But
a special doe kid.
Yeah, and Melissa, she's super flashy.
Oh, you know, I like the flashy ones in the Nigerian world. Come on now. I'm not really sure where my kids came from when Kisses popped out those two flashy mold-covered girls, because I don't know what I heard. And I thought, well, that's flashy. I told Nancy, maybe I should ask if she, like, slept with the mailman, because, like, that didn't come from Gunner's line. Oh, that's a bummer, Danielle. I feel like you're not alone, though. I have several singles in my herd right now based on my ultrasounds, and I feel like, I don't know. I mean, maybe we should just start using that PG600 like everybody else is doing.
It's going to be interesting because the next two does for me are PG600 does, and we did not ultrasound those.
Oh, I'll be excited to hear what that looks like for you, because I do think that we see a big difference when we use it.
Yeah, I will say that they look pretty big, but I've been saying that about all of my girls, so we'll see what happens there.
Hold on.
Oh, gosh.
I feel like we're not letting me revel in this victory enough. This has been the biggest comeback story of my life. This is like my high school varsity football moment, okay? Let me just have
this. When you're the water boy?
Drum roll, please, for John.
I mean, you know, when I'm 60 years old and balding, I'm going to be thinking about the good old days of when I won this bet, okay? So
you think you're going to keep your hair until 60?
Oh, have you met my father? Of course I am. We've got gold. We have locks. They might be gray, but it's thick hair up there, you know?
Okay.
So you had four singles, and I started out my kidding season with a single doe kid, followed by another single dough kid. And luckily, the third one for that day, Jem, was kind enough to have triplets, $2 in a dough.
Yep.
So that put on the pressure for Danielle and her last dough, who kitted this morning with that single dough kid. So that was a win, but then my fourth dough kitted this afternoon with a single dough kid as well. So if it weren't for good old Jem, this could have gone just a totally different way where we would have tied and had to have a tiebreaker. Oh, so yeah, this is great. It
would have been funny if you guys both had like four singles in a row, but like not funny. I do find, though, I'm not sure why, but I do find that I'm seeing a lot more single births in my clients this year as well. And a lot of people had recycling issues, even if they weren't using drugs. A lot of people had short cycling way more than I've seen in past years. So I don't know what it is, but it was a strange year.
I was trying to think back because we were working through a hay mow, and probably right around that time we had, and by we I mean me, I had decided that we were going to get through and empty this hay mow, and so some of the hay might have been older and so not quite as nutrient dense, and so it would be interesting to see if I had kept a record of when we were feeding what and when we switched over, those kind of things, because I have a feeling I probably did the opposite of a flush right around the time we were breeding goats. It would be interesting to kind of hindsight look back and see if that was the case, that I was feeding hay, because not that we're short on hay, but hay's going to be tight this year, and figured we weren't going to any more shows. We were just going to kind of coast along for a little bit. So might as well use up the stuff that probably only had like one more year of shelf life if I pushed it. Like this was the last year of its shelf life. So it would be interesting to see where that kind of fell in all of this. You know, four is also a lovely number because it's only four bottles to feed. It's not too bad. I think my goats were, you know, trying to keep my sanity this year. So we'll go with that.
Right where I'm at too. John, do you think you had any changes or anything that could equate? Because I feel like for me, it wasn't nutrition. I had that all consistent, but I made my move to the new barn around that time. And so I wonder, like, even though it wasn't like quote unquote stress, it was definitely new to them. And a lot of people, like when you look at the breeding research, you shouldn't do anything 30 days before or 30 days after any of those like special breedings. So I just wonder if that had a factor for my farm.
I didn't do anything super different. I around that time I did. Well, no, I was feeding Duraferm for quite a while, so that wasn't different. I think the does that had singles so far, they were thicker than a Snicker. Okay, they're a little chunky. So that could be it. If I had, you know, if I had to just throw something
in it. Just, like, admit.
Yeah. My one doe, Whisper, she's a third freshener. This is her third freshening in a row where she had a single. So I think she's just kind of one of those does.
Yep.
Yeah. So unfortunately for her, she might get the good old axe because of it.
Yep.
It's going to be really interesting in April when my really thick doe that's had about 50 Snickers, see what she throws, because she's as big as a house. She's the biggest doe on the block. So we'll see if she has multiples. But I honestly think it's just because the first fresheners, especially, they were just a touch thick when they came into it came into the rut.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have to ask, do I have a name I am naming my kid? Or is that a next week conversation? Are you still working on names? Where are we in that process?
Well, Danielle and everybody listening, this probably will not come as a surprise. But to be honest, I didn't even begin to think of a name before your dose, like until like your second or third single in a row, when I was like, oh crap, there's actually a chance here. So unfortunately for everybody, they're going to have to wait another week before they get a name and whatever goat that you decide to name this, which, by the way, you need to figure this out, Danielle, because you're naming everything that's born. Like, how dare
you? Hold the phone. Let me just back up a little bit. There's been 4 kids born.
Yeah.
Out of the whole thing. One of them is so 3 does, 1 buck. One of them's a buck. Right. It's not the one you're naming. The 2 does I am keeping have names. The 3rd doe doesn't have a name. She is technically for sale. Your fear. Meanwhile, I have also 5 more does to kid. And there are a lot of does in this 5 more does group that I would like to keep a doe kid from. So my thought is most likely there will be a doe kid for you to name from that batch.
Mm-hmm. And, unless you get a single buck kid.
Well, but then that's the thing. I would only have 2 doe kids I was keeping. And so I would probably keep this 3rd, and then she would need a name because she currently does not have a name because I wasn't planning on keeping.
See, I don't like this. And this is why. This is why. Because you're like, oh, you get the consolation prize keeper, quote unquote. And a year down the road, you're like, I don't like the way she's turning out. And then she goes away and that awesome name that I picked for her goes away with her as well. So I'm not a huge fan.
The only reason she's not currently on my keeper list because I really like her is that I have her full sister in the barn. I am trying, when I'm looking at my does and the genetics that are there, I'm trying to keep slightly different genetic profiles in my herd because I have a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old that I don't have a daughter of that I would really like a daughter of. So The only reason she's not a keeper right now is because I have her in the 2023 version. So If I need to keep her, I would be happy. But just realistically, with a bunch of other does that I would like daughters out of, she's currently on the chopping block. But I would not be opposed to keeping her. She's a very, very gorgeous kid. I wouldn't sweat it because...
Okay, I guess I'll just have to get over it.
Yes, you'll have to get over it.
Yeah. Folks, if you want to like throw some suggestions my way to kind of help kindle the fire that I'm trying to scorch here,
send help. Send suggestions.
I've come up with a couple good ones though, Danielle. You like I've been sharing them with Danielle just to be like get like a temperature check, and with other friends. Some people think I'm going too easy on you, Danielle. I might have to just turn it up a notch.
Sure. Okay.
Sure. So what are the rules? Do we have to play by, like, do you have a naming theme? There's no rules. Does it have
no rules, no holds bar. It's just the person that is, you know, Danielle has the ability to say do better, meaning like she just hates the name and you gotta do better, right? So we'll see how many of those that she does.
I just want a creative, awesome name that it just needs to be epic and iconic, and that's why we have this do better rule. So
yeah. Yeah. You were probably sitting pretty on some funny names over here and creative names for like my animals, and I'm over here like, yeah, I didn't do my homework.
Yeah. Well, it happens, and there's not a kid on the ground yet for it, the name, but probably within 2 weeks there will be, hopefully. So we will figure it out and announce it when you finally figure out a name.
It'll be next week.
Okay. Love it.
Yeah. Danielle, congratulations on losing. I'm so happy for you.
enjoy your victory this year. You are welcome. It is my gift to you.
I expect an apology in my inbox from all of you naysayers by the time you are done listening to this episode. Thank you. Do we have any AGCA news for the week, Danielle?
We do. So the 2024 linear appraisal map is now available. If you go to the AGCA website and look under that performance programs tab, That map is in the linear appraisal tab, and you can see what parts of the country and the timeline of when the appraisers are going to be in those parts of the country for the 2024 season.
We were on that map, so hopefully we get it. I think we're in like July, so that'll be fun. But super appreciative of all the hard work that the PPM and the appraisers do during this appraising. What do you call it? Season, even though it goes for like a couple seasons here. I guess we can turn our attention to Dr. Melissa here and talk about CAE and yonis and CL and all the scary stuff.
Yes, but I guess first, because we've had Dr. Melissa on a few times, I think we should catch up and ask, how's it going at Chubby Acres? How is your kidding season treating you? Where are you in terms of the barn building? What's going on there? Tell us everything, and then we'll dive into the
Tell
scary.
us everything.
Tell us everything. Yeah, so I only have two goats that have kitted so far, but my odds are pretty good right now. I have three does and a buck. So that was a good, it was very nice to have that. And then I don't have my real, like, true kidding season hit until next, the end of this month. So that's nice. I kind of got my feet wet in the new barn, working out all the kinks with everything. But everything's going really well on the farm. I've had some changes this year with Sam moving to Wisconsin. So the Goat Wives Club has shifted and evolved a little bit to involve my friend Hannah, who is my current farm manager, since September of last year. And she just found out yesterday, actually, that she got accepted into Michigan State Vet School. So we were very excited out celebrating. And so that'll be nice. She'll be here in the state, but I'll be losing her in August. So I had some.
Oh.
Yeah, I know, right? But she's been with me off and on for 4 years. She's the one that finished her grad. She's a master's student, finished her thesis and everything, and just was taking another gap year. But she'll be around. She'll be around. She'll be Michigan, and that'll be great to have her. And then we've had several 4-H students and kind of revamped the internship program a little bit. So I currently have two awesome vet tech interns with me. They're doing a 200-hour internship that is a paid internship until May. And then hopefully both of them sound like they're going to be joining my vet team part-time each. So I have a really great team right now, and I've been very excited because there's a lot of exciting things happening on my farm, including the dairy is almost done. So I'm hoping
Whoop,
that,
whoop.
I know, right? Long time coming. It's like, I feel like it's been forever, but hopefully I'll have the grade A certification by summer, probably another month, and the dairy will be done. And I'm super excited, and we'll obviously be having some type of tour that will be going on to show everybody kind of what I did and how I decided to do things once that is official. So yeah, lots of changes, but great things happening, and I'm excited. Summer
It
can't,
sounds
I can't wait for summer to get here for sure.
Like you're not busy enough, you know,
Yeah,
sure.
right.
Bring on show season.
Exactly.
Speaking of recent updates, you recently accepted and started working for Washington State University College of Veterinary Medicine as a small room net research associate. And yeah, it's awesome. Congratulations. And what does that job entail for you?
Yeah, thank you, John. I know if I didn't have enough titles, right, it might like
Yeah, and the feathers.
So I think some people thought it was a crazy decision because I took a leap from my small animal ICU job, which I don't know if you know that. I left that job in January, which was a huge step for me because I had been doing that in a nice consistent paycheck for a long time, and applied to this position at the Washington Diagnostic Lab, and officially took that job in September. And 50% of my time is spent basically in like research and development. So I'm doing a lot of review of the past 10 years of the small ruminant data with wattle. And so that's just sheep and goats, and developing some research studies, working with my team, looking at a closer look actually right now at Yoni's disease testing in goats. So that'll be something that's really kind of up and coming, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about tonight. And then the other 50% of my time is spent teaching, which really speaks to, what I love about small ruminants and kind of sharing that passion with other people. And so I'm teaching on the student level, a lot of Zoom lectures. the producer farmer level. So I've done a lot of lectures with the different regions of Washington State, both sheep producers, a lot of goat dairy producers as well. And then also veterinarians that are interested in, you know, furthering their education in small ruminants. So that'll be more on the side of like AASRP conferences, the joint one with the bovine practitioners in September. Plus there's a couple spring conferences where I travel to Washington. So it's a really fun job. It's super exciting. I love being part of the university team. So I get to kind of hear about all of the up and coming things that are happening and stuff that we're seeing on the lab side of things. And so it's been a great transition, and I'm happy that I took the jump.
It sounds awesome, and congratulations again. And also thank you for once again being an advocate for that small ruminant field and furthering the research that is out there, because as we all know, the research and information is so often lacking or limited. And when there is positions like this open and having somebody fill it that does have the passion, particularly for dairy goats, because, you know, we're a little self-serving in that and that part in it as well, I think it just is tremendous for the industry. So we're very excited that you are doing this and working with them, and cannot wait to kind of see what comes out of it. And so as we're starting on this, one of the things you are focusing on, as you said, is that CAE and the testing that is being done for that. But before we dive into that aspect of it, I feel like so many people know to look for that CAE negative animals,
right?
But never really know what the heck that means further than that. And so can you explain what CAE is and how it affects goats?
Yeah. So thank you, Danielle. That was really sweet. I feel like that is definitely one of the main reasons I took this job, because I am on the other side as well. And I am part of the goat show and the breeder world. And I hear all of the things that everybody's frustrated with, but it's also things that I'm frustrated with too. So I hope even if there's just a small portion, I'll be able to help get some answers for all of us, because we're just as frustrated on, you know, the diagnostic lab side of things as we are on the producer farmer side of things, because we don't have all the answers yet. So CAE, I feel like I'll try to keep this brief because it could be a whole hour in itself, but I think it's important to remember that CAE is a lentivirus, so it's a viral disease. The equivalent in sheep is OPP, which is ovine progressive pneumonia. So just kind of important to kind of look at those two diseases together. And it stands for caprine arthritis encephalitis. So if people could remember those words, it actually describes what the disease does, because typically we're going to see arthritis, the arthritic version in older animals. So that's the kind of knobby knees, swollen knees, the goats that kind of walk or sit on their knees when they're not moving around. They can have basically old arthritis. The encephalitis version usually we see in younger animals, typically less than 6 months of age. And that's going to usually progress from weakness in the hind legs to paralysis, basically neurologic symptoms. And then the other one that comes up a lot is the hard bag or hard udder that people nickname. And that's the viral mastitis version. And that can be where the udders are more congested and oftentimes more seen kind of on the sheep side of things, where we start to see the production issues because they can't raise their young because we see more dam raising. We see a reduction in milk production there. So that's, I think, important on the producer farmer side of things, because it becomes an issue when they can't raise their young adequately. But I think, as many of us know, and especially if we are in the show world, the most of the affected goats actually show no clinical signs at all. And so that's why it is important to test for it if your goal is to have a CAE negative herd, because we're often not going to be able to look across the room at a show and be like, well, that goat has CAE. So it's hard to know who's transmitting it or slash carrying it and therefore transmitting it.
So how is it transmitted?
Yeah, so the main focus or way that the CAE virus is transmitted is actually it starts by infecting the white blood cells, which is important because that is how it travels throughout the body inside these white blood cells. So pretty much any secretion that the goats might have that would contain white blood cells will contain the virus. And so the most common one we talk about is milk. However, you can have blood, saliva, tears, basically any respiratory secretion that could contain the virus. And that becomes important in kind of the transmission that might be happening in adults. The most common form of transmission, which we all know and talk about by far, is the importance of the colostrum and milk transmission from dams to kids. But it can take about 2 months for us to see if that transmission has occurred. So that is kind of one of the issues with trying to diagnose the disease. And in adults, although we don't have a lot of research yet to prove this, and it's a much less likely issue that comes up, we can see transmission from adults to other adults. And there is maybe even some kind of loose evidence that it could be vector-borne as well if we're talking about secretions, including, you know, blood, where we might have mosquitoes or ticks or other biting flies that could potentially be transmitting it. And that's definitely one of the studies that we would love to do in all of our free time, because I know Dr. Claire Burbick talks about it, where we would love to have, you know, a couple adults in a herd with all negative CAE animals to know over the course of years and years, you know, do we see transmission if there was no other factor? But most of us don't have herds where there's no other factors, right? So it's really hard to do studies like that to prove. But once the infection occurs, that infection is for life. So it's very much like a herpes virus.
It's often the thing that most of us do not want to talk about, but it's so vital in maintaining a healthy herd. What is like some of the best practices for being a CAE-free herd?
Yeah, I think, John, one of the things I would say, like one of my soapboxes or things to talk about it is, I think if you own goats or sheep or small ruminants in general long enough, I think there's always this like dirty thing associated with a positive that might pop up in your herd. And I think that for a lot of people, honestly, if you talk to anybody, and I think many of us in the show world are open, and a lot of people that I've talked to are very open about, oh, yeah, I had this, or, oh, yeah, I started out very early on and got this. You know, you're going to have issues, and that's just part of raising small ruminants. But I think that trying to do everything you can and doing your due diligence would include maintaining a CAE negative tested herd to start with. So you're testing yearly to try to evaluate your herd and make sure you don't see any positives popping up. And I think the most important thing, as many of us are continually developing our herds and adding new genetics, to make sure we're testing those new additions. And we'll kind of probably get into that a little bit more about, you know, what that means. But the other thing, or by, I guess, best practices with CAE free herds, you can bring up the whole like dam raise versus bottle raising practices. And I really don't have a strong indication on one versus the other. I know most people know that I dam raise, but that's mainly due to my multiple jobs and multiple hats. And I think obviously, as you guys know, you know, if you're bottle raising, there's definitely an area there where you can help to reduce the transmission. But then on the flip side, just handling the milk and the hygiene, you know, your milk handling practices and your hygiene or biosecurity practices on the farm, I think also become important, because I think people forget, even though it may be a small part of the transmission, you could even be using something like a hoof boss, and maybe not hoof bossing your finger like I did last week, but trimming a hoof too short and you cause a bleeder, right? I mean, we've all done that. And, you know, then you've got blood contamination on that tool and you're going to the next goat. Even though that's a very minimal situation, that's definitely something where secretions, you know, you could have transmission. So I think just, you know, being aware of your biosecurity there, and also your biosecurity as things enter your herd, is really the biggest one. To try to maintain a CAE free herd, if that is your goal. And not everybody, you know, I think as we talk about, not everybody has that as a goal. And I do think, like, as I learn more and more about these diseases as a veterinarian, you know, I see where you can maintain two different herds if you want to. Mm-hmm. I think you have ethics there. For me personally, I wouldn't, but I do think it's an option. Of all the diseases, I think of the three big diseases we talk about, right, I think this one, to me, is the least scariest.
I think with CAE, you know, especially people that, you know, they'll say, oh, we raise them on CAE prevention. But with CAE, if you have a positive herd and you still raise kids with, you know, prevention, that's all fine and good. But I think the biggest thing for people to realize, because we all put a huge emphasis on it, is that you just got to be open and honest with potential customers about
your status of your herd. That's a big thing.
Right, right. And I think that's where like people want to make this like a dirty thing. And I don't think it should be a dirty thing. I think it should just be breeders being honest with other breeders and or new people coming into the goat world to just be honest and not have to feel like you have to hide something like that. Because I think if you are being honest, it's very easy to manage these diseases. I don't want to say very easy, mm-hmm. but it is easy to manage these diseases if you're smart about it. And, you know, it depends on what your goals are.
It's obviously a choice if you want to have a positive herd, negative herd, because, you know, if you end up with a positive animal, you have to make a choice of what you want to do with it. Are there ways to have a positive herd but sell the kids as raised on CAE prevention, or are those kids like doomed to get CAE from the start?
No, I do think, John, I think if you have a good CAE prevention program, I do feel pretty strongly that CAE is one of the diseases that you could maintain. You know, having those kids go on to feel pretty confident about having healthy kids go into other herds. So what I think the biggest thing is, you know, when you do have something like that happening on your herd, to speak with your veterinarian or, you know, speak with one of your mentors that may have a lot of experience with CAE prevention to come up with a protocol, because I think you want to make sure you hit all the high points. I think for me, some of the things that I think about and when I talk to big herds that have had CAE as an issue and kind of always get their advice as a veterinarian, because, you know, it's not something I've been doing for 20 years. Some of these herds have been doing it. So I always like to hear what they're doing. And things that I talk to my clients about are you're trying to break the transmission from dam to kid, right? So having these, knowing who's positive first, right, going into kidding season is helpful. Taping teats, I think, can be helpful just in case you miss one of those midnight births and you weren't there to, you know, catch the kids. But ideally you're pulling the kids right at birth and, plus or minus washing kids. There's really no studies to support that, but I do know, you know, it's not one of those things where you have to wash the kids, but I know some breeders do. But the biggest thing is not allowing mom to lick off baby, and trying to, you know, pull those kids right away. Keep treating the colostrum and milk, as you guys know, you know, and there's a lot of guidelines out there on how to do that. So just make sure you're doing that appropriately for the appropriate time. I do know some herds, although I feel like the colostrum is really, really important in these goats. And I just feel like looking at the research, or honestly lack thereof, there aren't really good colostrum replacers for goats. So powdered versions of colostrum over the counter, I would prefer if people were going to grab one. It's not cheap. So if you were doing it on a small herd level, the bovine IgG gold colostrum is probably the best one, but there's just not great powdered colostrum replacers out there. So I would much prefer a colostrum source from a CAE negative herd if you don't feel comfortable heat treating yours, rather than having a powder replacement. But and then raising those kids on CAE-free milk or heat-treated milk. And then testing every 6 months or at 6 months of age may give them another layer of security. At that point, usually 6 months of age is when we would say the earliest time would be to trust the test in kids. And then testing yearly, or some people test twice a year. They'll test in the spring and fall. But I think that if you're going to test once a year, the ideal time to test would be right before kidding season, so you can know how to segregate your herd. And then people, as you probably know, have two different strings. They may have a CAE positive milking string and a CAE negative herd milking string. And then just being aware of what order you're milking them in. And ideally, to be honest, having separate equipment if you could.
And I think one thing also going back to, you know, the testing in before kidding season, if you're testing in the fall, like early fall, you're just coming off of show season. If a goat was exposed, it might not pop positive for, you know, a test or two, you know, like a couple months. Sometimes, from what I understand, at least, you test them and they're negative, but then you test them a whole year later and they're positive. Now you've got a problem.
Yeah, John. So I use my herd as the example just to try to explain to people on how and when I test. So I actually typically test in October or November of every year. And that's because all of my kids that are going to be part of my yearly breeding stock are at that point greater than 6 months of age. Mm-hmm. I'm usually about 60 days out from show season.
It can take 2 to 3 months for the disease to show up. And so my last show of the season is usually the first week of August. And so by then I feel like I've had at least about 60 days, which in the most ideal world, you may want to wait a full 3 months, but a lot of people may not do that. I preg check with ultrasound. I don't preg check with blood tests, but if people were preg checking with blood tests, you may want to potentially wait another month, and you could confirm pregnancy at 35-ish days and do your CAE testing all in one shebang, because I kind of like to kill two birds with one stone. So I tell people, if you want, you can do that. I prefer to know who's positive or negative before I breed, but that's me. That's what I need to know. I have a clean slate before I start my breeding. I also know that no one's been recently vaccinated or recently stressed because there's not been any travel, shows, et cetera. And typically no one on my farm is going to be pregnant at that time. So you kind of take out some of the factors that are maybe talked about a little bit as what might be causing false positives.
So yeah, I think again, the biggest thing about when to test is depending on what your herd goals are. I think a lot of people really do want to maintain a negative herd. And so I would recommend testing yearly and then testing all of those new animals that are entering into your herd, ideally taking it a step farther and making sure that you're testing the dam and the sire, or at least talking to the breeder that you're getting the animals from and having a couple years of testing available to look at from their herd. And then I think most importantly, which people forget the one, because we talk about all of these tests as screening tests, but making sure we're testing any sick animals for those diseases when they come up. So I think those are kind of the big testing points or testing times.
So while we're on this testing time topic, I want to ask, because so often you hear, oh, well, now isn't a good time to test, or this is why I potentially got a false positive. And so often it's, oh, I just vaccinated the herd. This possibly created a false positive, or she's newly pregnant, false positive. Is there any actual merit in that?
I'm glad you asked that, Danielle. So the short answer is no. There actually is no merit in those comments, because we don't have any good data or research to prove that statement yet. I think that's definitely one of the things that a lot of us that are working for these labs want this answer to. We want the answer just as much as the producers and farmers want it, but there isn't enough research to support that. However, one of the things that we do talk about, because there's just no way to say 100% yes, no, is that anything that could cause non-specific reactivity or inflammation, like an infection, immunizations, recent pregnancy or pregnancy, stress, I think, is kind of stretching it a little bit, because people talk about, oh, well, you just transported her home and that's why she's stressed and she's positive. It could interfere with the test, but most of the time that's going to fall short if you retest in 60 days. So if you have a positive test and you're like, okay, well, maybe it's a false positive, most of the time, all of those things that, people talk about causing a false positive, it's not going to cause typically a positive again in 60 days. So whatever was happening, the infection, the illness, the recent vaccine, those type of things, usually you're going to have a retest and that can help answer that question for you. But I do hear a lot of people, just kind of sweep it under the carpet and be like, oh, it's just a false positive. And I can tell you firsthand from working with a lot of my clients that that's not the case. There's definitely tests where I've done the follow-up testing. When we talk about, the other diseases, the main one being yonis, where we've had positives on the ELISA screening test being positive and then a follow-up test confirming the positive. Because, the screening test is just what it is. It's screening the animals. So you're never going to have 100% perfect test, but it's supposed to be what it's doing its job, and it's testing for the ones that may be positive. So you're always going to have a potential for a false negative. But if you can imagine, depending on what herd you want, you don't want a false negative sitting around in your herd that actually has the disease that got missed on the screening test, and now it's infected your entire herd. That's the worst case scenario, right? So when you develop these screening tests, you want to err on the side of, oh, well, we had a false positive, but then when we followed up with additional testing, like in the case of yonis, we realized that it truly was a false positive or truly was a false negative. And I've had both in the past year with my own clients and working with Waddle, and it's a little bit interesting with the new testing, where I don't think people should be sweeping that one under the carpet anymore.
Oh, no, that's good. And I definitely want to talk about that in a little bit, because I have plenty of kind of stories that of like the Yonis interact and the Yonis tests around here. So I'm excited we're going to get to kind of clear this up and talk about the new testing. I want to just really quickly ask, kind of in that idea of other things, what, and I know you mentioned it briefly in the beginning, what about colostrum antibodies from CAE positive does that their milk has been heat treated? Is that going to potentially affect testing for kids that have been fed that colostrum?
So usually that's where the 6 month marker comes in those kids that are 6 months of age or older, that's where you're going to usually be able to get rid of the possibility of like a false positive. So if you wait until they're 6 months of age and you test them, if they're negative, they're typically going to be truly negative. And if they're positive, they're probably going to be truly positive. CAE though is a viral disease. So it's actually, and it's a pretty easy viral disease to kill. Because it wants to live in the body, in the cell. It doesn't maintain for very long in the environment. You know, we're talking days, if that. And it doesn't, it can be killed pretty easily with heat treatment as long as you're following the guidelines. So I think that if you heat treat milk or colostrum and you feed that to the kids, you have a pretty safe measure. I mean, I know, yeah, nothing in life's 100%, but if you test those goat kids, at 6 months of age or older, you're usually going to be able to feel pretty confident in those test results.
And then I just kind of, speaking of environments and different things about that, what about transmission through frozen semen or even just breeding in general?
Yeah, I wish I had that answer because that question's come up a lot. Doing laparoscopic AI, you know, a lot of people talk about that because you have these fancy genetics from this herd or this goat that you knew was CAE positive because it's cell bound as a virus. So there is, in theory, when you look at the way the virus works, it could be attached to the egg, so the white blood cells potentially in the semen, because there's going to be sometimes white blood cells in the semen. So it depends on how it's processed. In theory, it's possible, but I can't tell you after, because I asked this question to all of my vet colleagues as well, because I want to know the answer. You know, I'm doing artificial insemination and lap AI and those and embryo transfer. And so I would love to know the answer, but nobody's been able to show a case yet to prove that. There is some theory that it could be transferred in utero. But again, that's not been proven either. So those are just things where we're like, okay, well, this is how the virus works. So in theory, it could happen, but there hasn't been any case reports to document it at this point.
So I'm going to kind of backpedal for a second here. And this is kind of more for our newer listeners. We have a ton of new listeners, newer type goat owners. Let's just kind of go to the basics. We want to test our herd for CAE. We are scared to draw blood because we've never done it before.
Yeah.
What do you need to do and what do you need to have? And are there any like tips and tricks for people out there?
Yeah. So my biggest one, and I do this with my clients, because if I don't have to come out and draw blood for your yearly testing, I don't want to. I mean, I love drawing blood, but a lot of times we'll use it as like, this is the yearly herd health evaluation, or we're evaluating the flock for the herd so I can set up my valid client patient relationship for the year. But I will usually teach them. I think that fine to me, there's a learning curve. And I think that you learn a lot easier and faster if you have somebody holding your hand and teaching you how to do it. And kind of going through the motions. So whether that's a vet tech or a veterinarian or a mentor that's really good at drawing blood, definitely have somebody come out that is comfortable doing it, I think, to demo it. And then I just have my clients draw all the blood while I watch and just kind of help them and give them some direction. So I think that's key number one. I think shaving a small spot on the neck, don't be afraid to do that either when you're first learning. I mean, goats can have pretty fluffy coats and they can be pretty well protected, so you don't have to worry too much about, you can shave a small little spot. And definitely
shave them.
Yeah, definitely. When I was teaching students, like, that's probably my number one go-to is I'm like, don't be afraid to shave a spot, you guys. Holding the neck slightly off to the side a little bit. So rather than looking straight on, if you turn them away from the person that's drawing the blood just slightly. I think that that sometimes helps in small ruminants to kind of highlight that vessel. And then my trick, which if you get really good, I put them on the milk stand and I use the square feeder bins, and I put one feeder bin in the rack, right? The one that fits in nicely. And then I tilt the other one upright. Again, I have Nigerians, so you might have to modify it for standards, but that tilts them up just right so that they have to reach their head out to eat the grain. And I just draw blood while they're in the stand.
So, I do it all by myself.
I feel like that's the best time to do it, because rarely, they'll flinch when you poke, but they're too grain driven that they don't care and they just keep eating. So if you can get good enough to be comfortable doing that, that's how I teach my students to do it. And it's different, right? Because you don't have somebody holding the neck in perfect position. But if you can get used to doing it on the side, I'm right-handed, so I usually do it on the goat's left side. And I hold up with my left hand and just go on the left side of their neck while they're eating. And I find that works really well, especially when I'm at a farm where the owners don't want to hold. I'll just set something like that up with whatever they have and work very quickly.
Yeah, I set the head stanchion as high on, because I have a Premier Ones stanchion. So as high up as it'll go, basically, where the goat's not going to choke.
Exactly.
Yeah, and just with my left hand, just put my thumb over the vein where, try to block it off so it'll pop a little bit. And then there you go.
Yeah. And I think I tell people too, John, to back up a little bit for people that are starting out. I think you also have to think about what are you going to do if you have a positive test result? I think that I have that conversation all the time when owners want to talk about testing, because there are people that aren't going to do anything about it, and that's okay. But for me, I'd rather you spend that money, depending on how many goats you have, how many goats you're testing. Maybe you need a new fence so that the buck stops breaking out and breeding your females, or maybe you want to buy some more expensive hay for the year. There's other places where you can potentially put your money, and it might not be the best thing to spend your money on yearly testing, especially if you have a truly closed herd, which I'm going to put that in air quotes because I feel like there are not a lot of truly closed herds. But if you truly had a closed herd, you could likely go to testing every 3 years, especially if you have an adult herd. Because most of these diseases that we talk about, CAE, even CL, and then for sure yonis, we start to see this disease in 2-year-old goats. So if you have 3 and above where you haven't seen disease positive testing popping up, you can feel pretty confident as those goats get older, it's much less likely that they're going to have those diseases.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. I want to ask, and then we'll kind of dive into all of that testing. One of the other things we see so often is that where you are sending the blood a reputable lab. How do we as breeders know what is a reputable lab, what isn't? Are there red flags that we should look for? What is your advice on that?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because they're definitely not all labs are created equally. So the biggest thing that you want to look for is a fully accredited lab by the American Association of Veterinary Laboratory Diagnosticians. And so that's most of the time going to be a USDA state lab or veterinary lab. So most of the veterinary teaching hospitals or diagnostic labs are going to be fully accredited. And I think the main reason for that is you're trying to find a lab that has quality control, training protocols, is a fully accredited, and then they have continued proficiency Q&Q. So you've got the quality assurance happening all the time on those labs. It's not like they just do it once and then they're done because they've been certified. And I think the other big thing is all of the university labs and the veterinary teaching labs, they're going to be employing individuals that are actively working with producers and researchers on these topics all the time to try to come to terms with what is the answer to this question? Because we get calls all the time at Waddle about what to do with this positive and what to do with this. And we don't have the answers for everything yet. So a lot of times, working with those labs, even if you're a farm potential that let's say, God forbid, you did have a yonis outbreak or you do have an adult CAE herd, reaching out to the labs and being like, hey, I have a positive herd. I would love to know where those herds are because we're going to be doing yonis research. So let me know. But I think that, you know, it's a great working relationship. The things to be careful about is sometimes the marketing is very good. There are some labs that use the words university and research, and then it makes people think that they are, you know, accredited. And so you got to be careful about how those words are used. There's some labs that use the words USDA certified, but what they're really saying is that they're using a test kit that is USDA certified. And I think the biggest one that I have seen recently is clients will get goats that have been tested from XYZ lab that's not accredited, and they're using the old IDEX Yonis, ELISA, versus then they get the goats and they want to retest because let's say they are, you know, one of those clients that are like, I just want to make sure I don't take any risk on the farm. So they'll retest, and they'll retest with Waddle or Michigan State or Cornell or Wisconsin, you know, all of the accredited veterinary labs that are now using the VMRD ELISA test for Yonis. And so that has a higher sensitivity and specificity. And so that's just one example where you may have been negative on the IDEX test for years, but now you're testing on the newer kind of improved sensitivity specificity test, and you're now popping positive. How do you explain that? And so that's one example, but I feel like, you know, if you're choosing a lab that's accredited, they're always going to be on the up and up of, you know, what is the best test out there? And they're constantly changing that to reflect what's best for us as producers. That makes sense.
Oh, it absolutely makes sense. It's insane that there's like so many like workarounds that they try to find for this. Now, in your job, you now are looking at the data from Waddle, which for years was the only and still is the premier testing facility. What kind of information are you pulling from the data?
Yeah, so you mentioned Waddle because I think that a lot of these labs, to go back to what Danielle had asked, they will accept client submissions. So you don't have to submit through a veterinarian. And there are some that, like Wisconsin, if you're submitting as the client, like I do a lot of Yonis testing, follow up with clients, I just have to sign off on it as the veterinarian, but they can put everything in as the client, you know, collect the samples, that type of stuff. I just have to be overseeing it. So, you know, take that. And keep that in mind too, because as a client, you can submit to Waddle and Michigan State and a lot of these labs. So the big thing that we're looking at, the first one we started with actually was Q fever and abortion diseases, because I think that's kind of one of the things where we just wanted to see an update in numbers on what the prevalence is in some of these diseases. There was some recent data that came out of Cornell on some of the kind of incidences, you know, on the kind of East Coast, West Coast side of things. So it'll be interesting to see what the numbers are. I've found so far, like with Q fever, it's definitely lower than I thought it was going to be as far as like the prevalence. But you have to remember, and this is one of the problems with some of these labs, and one of the things that kind of my pet peeve as I dive into the data is like, you guys need to make whoever's submitting the test tell you why they're submitting it. You know, is it a screening test? Is it a, you know, follow-up because there was a positive? Is it because the goat is sick? Is it because this is a grade A dairy, you know, or again, you know, biosecurity screening? So it'd be really nice to know why all these samples were tested, because you can say the prevalence is XYZ, but like, I don't know, were those all diseased? So it's skewed, or was it all screening? So it's probably a reality of what the real prevalence of Q fever is. But yeah, so we're looking at the abortion diseases. And then the next thing up is this biosecurity panel that we're talking about. So CAE, CL, and Yonis. And I'm really kind of excited to dive into that data. I've been looking at it a little bit because I definitely think these diseases are more common than we think, because nobody really wants to talk about them. So it'd be interesting to see that. And more, yeah, right. And then more so the follow-up testing. So when you look at Yonis testing, the ELISA is a blood test, and then there's the PCR on feces, and then there's the culture on feces. So, you know, which herds did follow-up testing, and what does that look like too? So we'll be looking into that. And then the other big part is the parasitology data, which I think is big for all of us, but so regional, because when you look at Washington State, like I'm talking to the producers and was talking on neonatal care. And one of the things as I'm like reviewing the data, barber pole is just not a big deal for them. Like, must be nice. But like, barber pole's a huge deal for us in Michigan. And so regionally, you know, there's these differences too. And we're going to be looking at that data.
Let's talk about yonis. Because I can tell you're biting at the bit. Like, you're ready to go. You're chomping at the bit for it.
My soapbox. Okay, so I think the cliff note version is yonis is a bacterial disease. The big thing about it is it infects goats the first week of life. And so that is the confusing thing about the disease, is that the infective stage is the first week or two of life. And then you don't see the disease typically pop positive on the test until a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years out. So there's this huge gap where we don't know if the animal has yonis or not. And that's where it gets confusing for testing, because it's not like you have COVID and you have COVID symptoms and you take a COVID test and you're positive for COVID. You know, it's like acute symptoms, acute test positive, you know, okay. But this is a chronic disease, and obviously CL is a chronic disease as well. And so the testing is kind of confusing. So the newer test that came out in 2021 is the VMRD test. And so this test, the reason it's different from the IDEX test is it is validated and now licensed by the USDA for small ruminants specifically. Whereas a lot of the other tests that we use in small ruminant world are for cattle, and we have just adapted them for sheep and goats. Mm-hmm. So this one does have more sensitivity and specificity, but like any screening test, it's not perfect. It's an ELISA, so it's testing the blood, and it's testing for yonis antibodies. So it's just like you or I getting a vaccine. We're going to get the vaccine, aka, or get infected with yonis, and then it's going to take us some time frame to develop these antibodies, and then the ELISA test is going to test for those antibodies. So the antibodies are just telling you that, hey, at some point I was exposed to this vaccine or I was exposed to this disease. It's not telling you that, yep, I 100% have the disease. So that's where I think the confusion comes in, where people just, you know, want to disregard the test and it's not good and all these things, but it is actually doing perfectly what it's supposed to be doing. And that's screening your herd as a whole herd for potential yonis. And so then you're going to take these yonis positive goats. And a lot of times people were saying, oh, just switch to the yonis PCR test for feces and just call it good. Don't even do the ELISA test. It's a waste of money. It's a waste of time. And what we are finding in goats specifically is that's not true. The fecal PCR, and this is what I thought 2 years ago, and now with my research and development team, and we've been talking to Wisconsin and Michigan State and some of the other big labs in yonis disease testing, that we're finding that what we thought was going to be the end-all be-all test, which was the yonis fecal PCR, which, to back up on that, you're testing feces from the animal, you're sending the feces in, and then you're looking, the PCR is looking for little DNA fragments or pieces of DNA. So it's a much more sensitive test. But what we're finding in goats is that unless you have a high shedding level, that PCR is going to miss some of these animals as well. And so then you go to the final definitive gold standard test, which is a fecal culture, which used to be the end all be all. But as you can imagine, we live in this like Amazon world where we want results like right now. Like I live in that world too. And the culture takes 60 days approximately. So you can imagine none of us really have the patience for that. But the scary thing is that we have seen ELISA positive, PCR negative, and culture positive animals. And so there's no doubt in our mind, culture is a definitive diagnosis. And most of these labs, well, I shouldn't say most, all of the labs that are doing fecal cultures, because yonis cultures is pretty specific and very hard to do. And right now there's like five labs in the country that still offer culture. One is Wisconsin, one's Michigan State. And so those are labs we're working with closely. They will go and they will PCR test the culture positive to confirm that it is truly yonis. So like there's no doubt in your mind after that it's positive. So when I started finding these cases, you could imagine that for me as a veterinarian and as a producer, I kind of freaked out. I was like, we're going to be missing some animals. And to me, that is the key animal that you don't want to miss, because they're not shedding at levels high enough to have a positive PCR, which means that they're probably not shedding at levels high enough to infect your herd yet.
Yet.
And if you can screen those animals, ELISA positive, it pops them up, it alerts you or your veterinarian or whoever that, hey, we might be here. And you could pull those animals out of your herd before you go into kidding season, before you have these young kids potentially exposed to the environment, AKA, you know, potentially yonis, if you've waited a year and it's been dropping everywhere, you could potentially stop the transmission of the disease for your herd and prevent it from coming into your herd. Versus, like John, you were saying earlier, where people test and maybe you only wait at 60 days after show season, and now you wait an entire year again before you retest.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a couple positives just sitting in your herd, but you didn't, you know, you tested too soon. So that's the same thing that we're doing with yonis, right? We test for it yearly and then we wait an entire year. Well, we might be missing some of these. So in the past, people would just say, oh, ELISA positive. And even some of the big names in yonis research, you know, were saying that as well. But we're starting to see that maybe the PCR is not as sensitive as we thought. And so now we're back at the, you know, back at the chopping block of what do we do with these tests, because it seems like we should be paying attention to these ELISAs. And that all happened because there was a ton of positive ELISAs starting to happen when people started switching over to the VMRD test. And we were like, what's happening? Well, it seems like it's a better test, yes, but it's also catching some of these animals that were probably walking around with yonis that we weren't catching in the old test.
Oh, that's so interesting. And I kind of think too, some of the animals that I know that have come back with a positive for yonis. And I mean, the first time it really crossed my radar was probably 10, 15 years ago, where somebody had a few goats and they just tested one because they thought that that was the right thing to do and came back positive. Then they had this freak out and very much spiraled with that in, is this animal actually healthy? Am I transmitting it? What does it do for my herd? And at that time, it was very much, this isn't the best test, because it was just that simple ELISA test.
Right.
And it isn't the best test, but they weren't really willing to do that second fecal test because it just wasn't where they needed in that direction where they were going. But it was a concern. And then in the back of your mind, it was always, well, do they have yonis on their farm? Do they not? Right. Several years ago, I attended a lecture and it was basically, we're using yonis testing only as a diagnostic tool. Granted, this was in my undergrad. I don't even want to count how many years ago that was, but it was what we have for yonis is basically a confirmation of the symptoms we're seeing. And so kind of in my mind, I look at my herd and go, okay, I have my old does. They're living their lives. We should be good, because at that point you would have seen potentially the symptoms. So it's not something I really should be testing for, because there is not that accuracy. But it's also one of those things that when it pops up, it's like you said, that there's now this research that's saying there's a reason for it popping up. And it is something that we should at least start to think about looking at in our herds.
And I think that's the same question, though, we circle back of, if you're going to test your herd, why are you testing your herd? What are you going to do with the positive test, right? And I think everybody has a different answer to that. But on the flip side, some people are like, oh, it's yonis ELISA positive, I'm just going to call it. Well, like hold the brakes, because like that might not be the answer either, because we do have these confirmatory tests now. It's just whether or not you want to do them. That we can be pretty confident in. And like for me, I think to summarize the three big diseases, if you have a CAE positive, you should retest in 60 days and circle back at that, right? Like you should look at that. As long as it's the appropriate age and you know, you've done all the testing appropriately, you circle back in 60 days and retest. If it's positive, you can probably pretty well trust that. If you have a CL positive, you should probably just be culturing abscesses. And I think we can all relate to that, but like most of the time you're going to culture an abscess if your CL positive, you're going to have a culture positive. Like, that's usually the definitive test. And then if you have yonis, though, now we're kind of looking at, if you have a ELISA for yonis, you really probably shouldn't be ignoring that. And instead of doing just the PCR, because I think if you have, do the PCR, you save money, do that first. If the PCR is positive, you have yonis. There's no question. The PCR test is testing DNA. So there's no question there. There's no false positive with a yonis PCR test, because you're literally testing at the DNA level. And so they can look at the differences between chicken exposure, because I have two chickens on the farm, or chicken exposure because I have 200 chickens on the farm. What is it? You know, what is the exposure rate if there's something like that causing a false positive? And then if you really want to know at the end of the day, you can do a culture, which, quite honestly, I think, you know, we do talk about expenses, but the culture, for what it is worth, it's like $40 or $45 at these major labs, and it takes them 60 days to culture it. Like, they are losing money from these tests, but they're just trying to help the producers to get the answer, right? So, like, in reality, other than having to wait 2 months, the testing itself is not cost prohibitive. And that's going to be your definitive answer there. So I think the screening test is what it is, but you have to decide, are you going to do anything about the screening test? Because if not, then, you know, you could say, why do it?
No, exactly. And do you have any tips for, so a herd like myself, I test for CAE, but again, was kind of under the mindset, accuracy of yonis is not there, not worth spending my money on that. But when would or when should I start testing for yonis? Is it that I'm seeing something that I suspect has yonis and then that's when I'm starting? Is it like, is it just because it's Tuesday and might as well draw the blood? Like, when should you start looking at yonis?
That's a really good question, Danielle. And I think that for me, I would say you had started off with, you have an older herd that's healthy. And I think those are big things. But I would also drive home the point that most goats do not have the classic wasting away, skinny, diarrhea, poor doer appearance that cattle have. So keeping that in mind, because the vast majority of yonis positive goats look just like CAE positive goats, they're healthy. So I think I would definitely keep that in mind, because early on when we first started talking about yonis disease in goats, we thought that it was going to be the poor doers. And don't get me wrong, like, the poor doers should be tested for yonis for sure. But don't forget that it's more commonly a healthy animal that's shedding yonis all over the place that you don't know about that has yonis until it's too late. The other thing I would say is, if you are going to put money towards testing and you're only going to do one test, I would say, if you're only doing one test, I would do the yonis PCR. If you have a little extra money, I would love to see an ELISA and then test off the ELISA. But it really depends on how big your herd is, because your money might be better spent doing ELISAs on everybody, blood testing everybody, because you're already probably pulling blood for pregnancy checks and CAE checks, etc. And then if you have an ELISA positive pop up for yonis, then do a follow-up test with PCR, because that's where I think you're going to save your money. And if you're going to do, hey, you know what, one of the years I just want to do fecal PCR and I'm going to do pooled PCR testing. So there are a couple labs that offer that. Michigan State is one of them. Wisconsin is one of them. I know there's a couple others, but I have most familiarity with them. Then my recommendation would be two things. Group your animals based on age. So if you're going to do five goats, do your 5 5-year-olds, do your 5 4-year-olds, you know, do your 5 3-year-olds, and then do your like 5 young stock, whatever that might be, right? So do age appropriate groups so that you're not mixing them, a 1-year-old with a 2-year-old with like a 6-month-old or so for some reason, and then like your 8-year-old. So do age appropriate. And then my other recommendation for that would be, if you're doing age appropriate, and if you can, in the ideal world, a lot of the researchers in the background are talking about multiple samples, because there's been some research in cattle that if you sample them over the course of several days and you mix all that feces together, the sensitivity of the test is higher, which just like makes sense, right? Like that research wise makes sense, but like, I don't think we all have time to collect feces from our goats 3 days in a row. Mm-hmm. That said, though, let's take the example of maybe you have a herd of 60 animals. you ELISA test them and there's two positives and you're like, oh crap. I would absolutely take feces from those two animals for 3 days in a row and submit them to Wisconsin or Michigan State or whatnot. If it was my personal herd, because I want a zero tolerance, I would do PCR testing and culture. And then I would cross my fingers for 60 days and hope that the culture was negative. Because if both those are negative, then you can walk away. And I've even had clients tell me, would you write me a letter saying that I want to sell goats and I've done XYZ testing that you feel confident that my herd is disease negative for yonis? And I would say, yes, at this point, based off of these three tests, you have a yonis negative herd.
Right.
So, I mean, I think there's utility behind those tests, but you do have to take each one of them because they can be very confusing. You have to look at each test individually and what you're wanting for that individual goat or for that herd.
No, it's interesting. And it's I mean, yonis, I feel, and again, as we've kind of talked about, it's just, it's such a new area of biosecurity.
Right.
And we are definitely still learning on what is those best practices. I do want to touch on CL really quick because there's a few things I want to ask, and we've taken up a lot of your time already. So, but I do want to just hit CL really quick. Obviously, that best practice is if you have an abscess and it's, well, if you have an abscess, sample it, send it out for testing. If it looks that correct color, send it out for testing. Should you be testing your herd in that biosecurity panel for CL as well? Or do you think just as long as you're diligent about absences, you should be okay?
Yeah, I think the second one, Danielle. And I think the only reason when I talk to clients, because Waddle does have the nice biosecurity screening panel. And I think it's also because, you know, we are trying to look at the data more too. And so for me, it's like, you're already sending blood. You might as well, like, it's maybe, again, do you have a herd of 200 or do you have a herd of like six? Mm-hmm. A couple extra dollars for a herd of six is very different than 200. So, but I don't push the CL blood test because I think that in general, for me, there's more stock in, are you culturing the abscesses on your farm? And more importantly, are you doing appropriate quarantine or isolation for something that has an abscess until the culture comes back? Because that's where you're going to break the disease transmission is, you know, trying to catch those abscesses ideally before they break open, which, you know, in fluffy goats and sheep, it's hard. So making sure you have hands on those animals all the time as much as possible, but culturing is going to be way more, you're going to have way more, I guess, confidence behind that test versus a blood test for CL. And I think that, you know, 50% of the cultures, when we look at the Waddle data, that is something I'm looking at too with the research, but 50% of them approximately are not CL. And so there's a lot of common pathogens. We see actinomyces come up a lot, staph aureus, strep, the big ones are, you know, those are the big ones that are going to respond to common antibiotics. So I think just quarantining, addressing it with antibiotic support, and then waiting for those test results to come back. So hopefully you're not exposing your herd if God forbid it is CL.
So you're saying if somebody has a goat at a show with an open abscess, we shouldn't all freak out and think, oh my goodness, it's CL. But also, people, don't show your goats with open abscesses.
What right. are you doing? Both of those things, right. Right.
Yes, the answer is yes to that.
And I do, I have all those, you know, every single one of my clients has the same response, which again, I was there too when I first got goats, especially as my veterinarian. I was like, oh my God, it's CL, the world is ending. Like, what am I going to do? And the vast, vast majority, I would gather to say, like for me, at least even when I'm testing my clients, it's more than 50% are not CL. Mm-hmm. So yeah, yes, don't freak out, but also don't bring animals with abscesses.
Yeah. And so with those, I guess the next thing is if you do have a herd that has CL in it, people tend to vaccinate their herd against that CL. And then my understanding is then that those animals, because they are vaccinated, will always show positive. So you will never know if the animal has CL or has been vaccinated, correct?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest thing to know is that if you have a CL positive farm, you do have to kind of make a decision on whether or not you're going to vaccinate or not, because the vaccine itself, it does work to reduce the abscess formation, which ultimately is the way that it drips into the environment and contaminates your environment and causes continued spread of the virus, right? But it doesn't reduce the disease itself. It's just trying to reduce the abscesses from forming and therefore reducing the transmission of the disease. So there are herds that are CL positive and want to start to do the yearly CL vaccine. And it's important to remember, though, like CL has a pretty long incubation period, usually about 3 months. So if you're trying to do like a CL eradication program and you're trying to keep the negative herd negative and therefore not vaccinated, and the positive herd, you know, positive and vaccinated, et cetera, a lot of people with eradication programs talk about testing every 3 to 6 months and then separating CL positive and CL negative. But even when you like talk to Claire Burbeck, and we talked about that in one kind of rescue herd that I was working with, it is really hard to maintain two herds, like a CL positive and CL negative herd, just because at some point, even if you have the best biosecurity, and like I have different colored buckets for every single one of my animal groups on my farm, like there is going to be a breakdown where you may have some cross-contamination. And
right.
And if it's during an open abscess, well, great. Then, you know, you've got issues. But yeah, you do have to be really careful about that. And I think that's really hard because especially in the sheep world, it's just kind of like a thing. Like you just assume that everybody has CL because they just don't work to keep it out of their flocks as much as we do, I think, on the goat side of things. So,
well, they're mostly terminal. So they don't, right,
exactly.
By the time it's a huge thing, they don't care because they're gone. Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%, John. And I think that's a really good point, too, when you talk about, like, the CAE stuff. Like, I know there's some people that will let the bucks that are going to be terminal bucks for meat still nurse or dam raise. You know, mm-hmm. So like, what is the ultimate end result or purpose of the animals, I think, is important when you talk about these diseases as well.
I think we've covered everything here.
I know! We did a good job!
I like pat on the back to everybody around. Like this has been great. This is an awesome, awesome episode. Before we wrap this up, we've taken up a lot of your time. I just want to say something real quick because I forgot about it till just about 5 minutes ago when I was talking to you about my doe Gem the other day. You were mentioning that you had like some secrets that you were keeping.
Oh man, John!
You thought I forgot?
Man, I was really hoping you had forgot. Yeah, so I figured I would try my hand at maybe getting some goats from, you know, a herd on the West Coast that I've been getting a lot of spotlight animals from lately, and figured maybe I should get on her reservation list. And so I did that a couple of years back and finally got my Frosty doe coming. So,
oh, yay.
No, Janie's got a gun, Frosty. So I have a doe kid coming from her. So I'm super excited that finally worked. And she'll be flying here next month. And then she's coming with a friend from Sweet Emotion. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
This is the year that all my reservation lists are coming together, whether that's a good thing financially or not.
So you're goat rich, but you're money poor.
I've also have some new goats coming in from a herd that I've been on that list since I went to my first national show. Which was actually in Louisville. So it'll be full circle. And I will have some Agape Surprise goats coming as well. So that's kind of exciting.
Wow,
I will
Steph, you're really, that. You're killing it.
I know, right? So I'll be announcing that soon, but I'm super excited because this is going to be great for kind of advancing my genetics further. And it'll be working within a lot of my genetic lines, which I like to do because I have some Cyrus Quinn stuff with my Miley Cyrus doe, which she's looking fabulous. I can't wait to see her as a first freshener. That's my spotlight animal, consignment animal from Nationals. So I'm really excited about her from Little Miss Behavin. So yeah, it'll be a fun season. I'm really excited about show season. I've got my national list roster already started. I'm sure you're as nerdy as I am. Like it's ready. Like I keep changing it, but like I'm ready. It's 4 months away, 12 weeks away. What is it? I'm ready. Countdown begin.
Let's go. Well, we'll see you there.
I can't wait. John, we're literally going to have those Grinch juice drinks this time for sure.
Let's do it. I'm up for it. It's my birthday week that week, so let's go.
Yes, we will celebrate for sure. Danielle, are you going to be there?
I will be there, yes, and definitely would be more than willing to try
A green drink?
a green drink, yes.
Awesome. I can't wait to see you guys in person. So have a good night, and it was great chatting with you both.
Well, before we let you go, you gotta plug your stuff. Dr. Melissa Hollihan, Chubby Acres, where can people find you on the old social media?
So Facebook, I'm at Chubby Acres Farm. I also have Caprine and You Veterinary Consulting, which we will do Zoom consults for those people that are in other states. And you can find me at Washington State University now on their website. So pretty much any one of those emails go to my personal email. So I still answer about 200 something emails a day, but I am happy to talk about goats to anybody. So you can find me on any one of those sources.
Perfect. Thank you so much again for joining us. Danielle, loser of the bet, where can people find us on social media?
You can find us on Facebook by searching Ringside and American Dairy Goat Podcast. We are on Instagram and Facebook, or we are on Instagram and TikTok by searching Ringside underscore podcast. You can find us at dairygoatpodcast.com, and you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe, leave us a review or a rating. It helps us a lot, and we appreciate it.
You don't want to be a loser like Danielle, and you want to make sure you leave that review. Well, everybody, this has been Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast. I'm John.
And I'm Danielle.
Winners win and shooters shoot. We'll catch you on the next one. Bye-bye. Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast, is not an affiliate of the American Dairy Goat Association. All opinions or information regarding the ADGA does not represent the registry.